I am Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. The purpose of Resistance Radio is to help ignite a resistance movement to prevent the murder of the planet by capitalism and industrial civilization. To that end, every week I will interview some great writer or activist who is working toward the revolution of values we so desperately need if we are to stop this culture from killing the planet. Today's guest is Robert Jensen, no relation. He's a professor of journalism at the University of Texas, Austin, and he's the author of 7 books, including Arguing for Our Lives, Critical Thinking in Crisis Times, We Are All Apocalyptic Now, on the Responsibility of Teaching, Preaching, Reporting, Writing, and Speaking Out, Getting Off, Pornography, and the End of Masculinity, and Writing Dissent, Taking Radical Ideas from the Margins to the Mainstream. Hi, Robert, and welcome to the show.
Great to be with you, Derek. Thanks.
I've loved your work for years. So I think I'd like to start by asking you about an essay you wrote called Pornography is What the End of the World Looks Like. And so what do you mean by that?
Well, let's start with what I don't mean. I don't mean that pornography is going to bring about the end of the world. It's not a hysterical kind of claim. But for about the past 24 years now, I've had done some work on pornography, both research, writing, and activism. And so I've seen not only pornography, but what pornography does in the world. And the longer I worked on that issue, the more I realized that pornography was important not simply because of what we might call the material harms that result from it. What happens to people who are used in the production of pornography? What happens to people in relationships with men who habitually use pornography? Not just questions about what's the relationship of pornography to rape culture, all those are very important. But I think the other reason pornography is such an important issue is that it gives us a kind of window into the culture, or as I've written before, it holds up a mirror to us. And what it tells us about ourselves as a culture is not very pretty. Pornography is really about, in some ways, the end of empathy. It's a media genre that sexualizes the domination subordination dynamic that sort of defines heterosexuality, men dominating women, women submitting to men. It sexualizes that domination subordination dynamic, and when men are socialized to find sexual pleasure in that, what you see is essentially, among other things, the death of empathy. I think pornography contributes to a pattern in men of being unable to empathize primarily with women, men being unable to recognize how their sexual behavior affects women. But I think it generalizes beyond that. That domination-subordination dynamic in pornography is, of course, not the only domination-subordination dynamic in the world today. And I think that anywhere we lose our capacity to empathize gives us a glimpse into essentially what the end of the world looks like. That is, when we can not only fail to empathize with other people, but in a sense fail to empathize with the larger living world. And I realize that the claim, you know, pornography is what the end of the world likes, sounds hyperbolic, but in a very real sense for me, after nearly a quarter century of thinking about this, it seems all too accurate.
So how... You said that this is just one of the domination-subordination relationships. Let's try to be really clear. How does this, what are some of the other domination-subordination relationships that you're talking about? Right. And what is the relationship of this to, for example, capitalism?
Right. Well, you know, basically, we live surrounded in, bathed in, immersed in hierarchies of varying kinds. The hierarchy we've been talking about is male over female, which happens in a system we call patriarchy. A lot of people think that's an old-fashioned word. I happen to think it's still a very accurate word. We look around the world and we see patriarchal cultures. Now, those cultures can vary in dramatic ways. The contemporary United States is different than contemporary Afghanistan, for instance. But although the forms by which men dominate women can change over time and within societies, we're still talking about that hierarchy, the assumption of the inherent nature of male domination. And that's what patriarchy claims, that this is not something that men just do. It's something that's sort of inherent to human nature. Well, what we know from the history of human beings, of course, is that patriarchy is not a permanent part of the human condition. There were pre-patriarchal societies, and there can be, by definition, then post-patriarchal societies. But that naturalizing of hierarchy is very common whenever there is hierarchy. So you mentioned white supremacy, the claim that was made overtly for many hundreds of years that white people were naturally superior to and therefore appropriately dominant over non-white people. In the United States, that takes a particular intensity around white Indian relationships, white indigenous relationships, and white black relationships. And that's what we call white supremacy, again, a term some people feel is old-fashioned, but I think is very accurate. And again, the way that white supremacy plays out changes over time and among societies. The United States is not a white supremacist society in the same sense today that it was in the year I was born, 1958, for instance. But the underlying assertion of the naturalness of hierarchy remains. You mentioned capitalism. Of course, economic relationships in this society are based on hierarchy, on the right that some claim to acquire a grotesquely disproportionate share of the world's wealth and use it to their own advantage, ignoring the basic human needs and human rights of other people. Well, that's a kind of hierarchy. It's a domination-subordination dynamic. And again, it's attempted. There's an attempt to naturalize it. Rich people will tell you that they're just naturally smarter, harder working, whatever it may be. And therefore, this is kind of the order of things. So claims of hierarchy that result in this domination-subordination dynamic are often, or in fact, are almost always accompanied with claims that there's something about human nature that makes this inevitable, that this is immutable, that it really can't be changed. And as I said earlier, the problem is there are lots of times in human history when human societies were not structured on hierarchy. It doesn't mean that we can find some golden age in human history where everything was wonderful and people were loving and nice to each other and no one was ever violent. That's not the claim. The claim is that human societies need not be based on hierarchy and need not be based on domination.
So we've you've talked a little bit about some of the ways that the hierarchies are reinforced. I mean, you mentioned pornography, and I'm thinking that I think a couple of things. One of them is that one of the favorite lines that I ever wrote was that in Culture Make Believe, I wrote that any hatred felt long enough no longer feels like hatred. It feels like economics or religion or just the way things are. And so I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit about. So it's seeming to me that if you have to actually state outright that males are superior or whites are superior or humans are superior, you know, whatever it is that you're going to make as the superior versus the inferior other, that if you actually have to say that out loud, then that means that the rest of the propaganda isn't working well enough, because the supremacism works best when everybody just takes it at face value. This is the way things are. So can you talk about some of the ways, for whichever supremacism that you want to talk about, some of the ways that the supremacism or the domination can be naturalized?
Right. That's an interesting point. And the thing that came to mind was the history of white supremacy in the United States. Take our so-called founding fathers. Thomas Jefferson is the best example of this. Thomas Jefferson, like many of the founding fathers, of course, owned slaves. That slave system was based on an ideology of white supremacy, which very conveniently made economic domination easy. And there was a vigorous debate about slavery going back to, in some sense, probably as long as there's been slavery, but especially in the colonial period in America. There were early abolitionists. Tom Paine, for instance, one of the other founding fathers, although far less celebrated in the United States. As a footnote, Tom Paine is not celebrated in the United States as much, despite his many contributions to the American Revolution, in part because he was a radical Democrat. He believed in equality. And Tom Paine was an early abolitionist. In fact, the first article that Tom Paine wrote in the United States was an article on the argument for abolition of slavery. And so Thomas Jefferson had to argue for slavery. and in fact wrote tracts that justified slavery, incredibly racist and actually even kind of bizarre tracts sometimes. And so you had an overt discussion there of the need to sort of reinforce the ideology of white supremacy. And we look back at slave times and we think, wow, that was really awful, and of course it was. But you're pointing to something perhaps more insidious about contemporary white supremacy, is because we have abandoned chattel slavery and we have renounced the legal apartheid system that structured the U.S. long after slavery, now we believe that we've somehow transcended white supremacy. And the fact that the material reality, the economic realities of life, indicate we still live in a white supremacist society, no one feels the need to justify it. I think you're right. It's become part of the accepted background. And therefore, if, you know, black people are unemployed at twice the rate of white people over time, and that disparity has not lessened significantly over the last 50 years, that's not taken as a reason to discuss white supremacy, because we've eliminated the worst of white supremacy. Well, that just must be something we have to live with. And that gets reinforced year after year. And I think that in some ways, that's a more distressing state. And I don't want to be glib about it, because, of course, no one wants to go back to chattel slavery or Jim Crow segregation. But we have a much different struggle with racism and white supremacy today, and one that, you know, may be intractable. It may be impossible for this culture to overcome it. I don't know. But it's partly because, as you say, it's become woven into the fabric of the world in a way, and therefore the disparities are no longer even visible to most people.
And I don't know for sure that this is true, but I heard the other day that public schools in Chicago are more segregated now than they were pre-Brown v. Board of Education.
I don't know that specific example, but I do know that that's true in other places, and that it's also true of housing segregation. There are places in the United States that are as segregated, perhaps even more segregated in terms of housing than in the old Jim Crow era. That's the enduring reality of white supremacy in the United States. And the fact that it's easily known to anyone who wants to know it, and yet we still can talk about ourselves as being post-racial, or talk in very celebratory ways about having transcended racism because of the election of an African-American president, you know, the data on the ground doesn't lie, nor do the studies. And there's been a number of very good studies that indicate the depth of unconscious racism, in which the white majority, soon not to be the majority anymore, but for now the white majority in the United States, you know, that holds unconscious racist beliefs, which are easily demonstrated through a variety of different social science methods. Well, all of that, again, anybody who wants to know it can know it. It's right there at the surface. It's not some, you know, deep, lurking, complex reality. And yet, we don't know how to come to terms with it. And it seems to me that the fact that we don't come to terms with it is evidence of the sort of power of white supremacy. If we really had transcended racism and were no longer a white supremacist society, it seems to me we wouldn't have any trouble talking about this, because we'd be trying to figure out how to change it. If racial segregation and the economic disparities that come along with racial segregation, if the inadequate schooling that comes along with those economic disparities were so obvious, we would talk about the racialized nature of them. But we're terrified as a culture to talk about that, precisely because we know we have not transcended that deep white supremacy that defined us for so long.
You know, I keep thinking about, whenever I think about issues like this, I always think about R.D. Lang's three rules for a dysfunctional family, which are: rule A is don't, rule A1 is rule A does not exist, and rule A2 is never discuss the existence or non-existence of rules A1 or A2.
Yeah.
And the way this works in a domestic violence situation is that you can talk about anything you want except for the violence that you have to pretend isn't happening, or the incest or whatever. You know, you can talk about all these things, and you can't talk about the fact that you can't talk about them. And it's the same on the larger scale, that we can talk about all sorts of things except we can't talk about the fact that the schools are still segregated. So we can't talk about the fact that the economic disparity. We can't talk about the fact that corporations are killing the planet.
Yeah.
And
well,
go ahead.
Here's an example of how bizarre it can be. In the state of Texas, the University of Texas at Austin, where I teach, is the flagship school of the public university system, and it's a competitive admissions, and therefore a whole lot of kids in Texas want to come to UT, and not all can. And so for some time, we had an affirmative action program to try to deal with the deep legacy and ongoing reality of white supremacy in the state of Texas. Now, many people, myself included, supported that. If we had problems with affirmative action, it was that affirmative action wasn't vigorous and robust enough. I, for instance, have argued we need quotas, that you actually need to impose numerical quotas if you want to actually achieve something like a just educational system. Okay. Well, the affirmative action program was gutted in the 1990s. It came back in attenuated form in the early 2000s, and the Supreme Court yesterday just ruled on another challenge to it and sent it back to the lower court in a complex technical decision. But the argument here is that Texas may not need an affirmative action, race-based affirmative action program anymore, because we found a non-race-based way to address it. And that's what in Texas we call the 10% rule, which is that if you graduate from the top 10% of any high school in the state of Texas, you have automatic admission to the University of Texas at Austin. Now, the way that helped racial diversity was precisely because the school systems are still so segregated that there are school districts where high schools are predominantly black and brown, and therefore the top 10% of those high schools will be able to go to UT. In other words, our solution to the enduring legacy of white supremacy is rooted in the enduring legacy of white supremacy in the public school system. Now, that's, I don't even know, that's ironic, it's a paradox, it's insane, call it what you want. But we are so mute in the way that you're saying, so unable to talk about these problems, that even when we try to address them, we address them at a superficial level without recognizing that our so-called solution is based on the depth of the problem. I think your point is well taken and right on, that denial, the inability to face these problems, is works very similarly at the cultural level as it does at the level of a family, where everybody's had experience, if not within their own family, certainly within families we know, where that kind of denial was literally deadly. People die because of that kind of denial, and it's no different at the cultural level. People die because this culture cannot come to terms with racial injustice, economic injustice, and gender injustice. I think that's not at all an extreme statement. I think it's almost obvious.
You know, it ends up being, I really like what you just said. And I'm thinking about, also back to my book, Culture and Make-Believe, I'm thinking about how that book was supposed to be a five-page introduction to an encyclopedia of hate groups. And I started by asking, what's a hate group? And then I visited a KKK website, and that website said that they're not a hate group, they're actually a love group. And I thought, well, okay, shoot. So either A, the KKK is not a hate group, or B, we can't trust rhetoric. And if you can't trust rhetoric, what do you trust? And then I started thinking about it, and if you go just by the numbers, then the biggest racist segregationist organization in the country is the whole system, the whole judicial and penal system, because it's achieved segregation of African-American males on a scale the KKK can only dream of.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm just thinking, again, about how these various supremacisms end up. I've always felt like, if you mentioned earlier this sort of unconscious, the level of the unconscious, and if we have, I felt that if there's some sort of, if you fundamentally feel supremacist, white supremacist, male supremacist, human supremacist, it's going to come out, and unless you address the deeper issues, unless you address why that's there in the first place, if you stop one form of the supremacism from manifesting, it's going to come out in another way. And one more thing, which is, I think we see this all the time in relationships too, where if someone's unhappy in a relationship and so they raise some issue, which is not really the issue, but instead they raise an issue just because they're upset. And then if you solve that issue, they're just going to raise another issue. I'm sure we've all encountered that. And so can you talk about that on the larger social scale too, or do you think you've pretty much covered that?
No, I think you're absolutely right. And let's just take gender and the socialization men and boys in this culture receive. We talked about pornography and the increasingly cruel and degrading nature of pornography, the way that sexual gratification for the primarily male viewers of pornography is increasingly and more intensely tied to overt cruelty toward women and the degradation of women. Well, that's a problem. It's a big problem. And as I said, and as you're well aware, there's been, you know, now 30, 40 years of feminist research and organizing to try and highlight that problem, which the culture has been in deep denial about for the most part. But let's say you solve the pornography problem. Let's say, you know, magically pornography of that type could be eliminated tomorrow. It doesn't get at the deeper questions about how men across the board are socialized to find pleasure in domination. And here, you know, if you just go around the room in any setting where there are men and ask them to talk about how they grew up and were trained to think about women, how they were trained to think about themselves, how they were trained to think about gay men, it's all deeply patriarchal, deeply misogynist. It's all rooted in that need for men to feel dominant over women. And it plays out across the board. You know, it's woven into the fabric of the military and the training in the military. It's woven into the fabric of men's sports and the training in sports. Because, as you're pointing out, it's not simply a problem of a generally good system where one thing got out of whack. It's a problem of a bad system. And until we can say that openly, we will always be missing the point in the same way that, as you're suggesting, whether it's a family or just a interpersonal relationship, if people don't deal with underlying problems in a system, the best you can do is patch things up for a while. And, you know, sometimes patching things up for a while is better than the alternative, but it's not a solution. And that's where I think it's important to continue to make clear that we can make certain things better in the world. You know, we can, for instance, reduce the number of coal-fired power plants that produce electricity in the world, and that would be a good thing. But that's not a solution if by solution we mean actually coming to terms with the underlying problems of a high-energy, high-technology world with 7 billion people, which is not sustainable. And so, you know, going to these systemic and structural levels is really important. Now, not to go on too long, but the problem, of course, when you raise these questions, and I'm sure you get this all the time, is people say, well, you have to be realistic. And I've always found that amusing, that if you try to deal with the fundamental systemic and structural problems, you're told you're unrealistic. But if you try and deal with superficial manifestations of that system, patching them up, hoping that somehow that will solve the problems, somehow that's being realistic. In other words, the strategy that is doomed to fail is magically transformed into the most realistic strategy. And that's pretty crazy, I think.
And I think that's one of the reasons that we stay... that's one of the ways that the supremacism, that the oppression is naturalized, is because we, I mean, it's there inherent in what you just said, that that's what's realistic, is that realism is staying within the system. And part of the problem, of course, is that capitalism has to declare itself the only way to be. It's part of the problem with all of this, I think, is sort of a monotheism or a mono something, a monopoly, really, that patriarchy is the only way that has ever been. Capitalism is the only way it's ever been. And you can't really deviate. So all solutions have to come from within that.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, well, I was just thinking of the place where that is the most bizarre claim, and you're right, it gets made all the time, is capitalism. Now, you know, patriarchy, depending on how you chart it, it's been around, 8,000, 10,000 years maybe. And that's a small part of human history. The modern human has been on the planet for about 200,000 years. So at best, you know, patriarchy constitutes maybe 5% of our evolutionary history. White supremacy, as we understand it today, is at most, you know, 500 years old, an even smaller chunk of human history. But capitalism is a system that only developed in the last, depending again on how you chart it, 200, 250 years. The rise of the human exploitation of coal first, then oil and natural gas, the Industrial Revolution, the shift from basically feudal relations to mercantile relations and eventually to capitalist relations. That's all part of very contemporary history. Yet when I critique capitalism, and I'm sure this happens to you as well, people will say, well, that's just the way we've always done. There's always been buying and selling and trading. So people take any economic activity where people buy and sell or trade and assume that modern corporate capitalism is the same thing. Well, it's crazy. Yes, people have been exchanging goods and producing goods and distributing goods, but it hasn't been a human history defined by capitalism. For most of human history, even the basic notion of buying and selling didn't exist. You know, in gathering and hunting societies, nobody was setting market prices for anything. You know, you're talking about the need to naturalize, which is so, I think you're right, so much at the heart of claims of the legitimacy of hierarchies. And there's two versions of it, it seems to me, in at least in the contemporary United States. One is theological. For instance, patriarchy is defended by many conservative Christians as God's will. It's right there in the text. Of course it's patriarchy. Now, men should be patriarchal. They should take their place at the natural, their natural place at the top of a family unit, for instance. But they should be benevolent patriarchs. They shouldn't beat their wives. They should treat their wives kindly. So it's not an argument against patriarchy when conservative Christians start critiquing some of the modern era. It's an argument for patriarchy. Now there's a secular version that used to be called sociobiology, now often is called evolutionary psychology, which tries to make the argument that basically this is just the way we're wired as animals, which again is refuted by most of human history. So this claim to naturalness comes in various forms, but you're absolutely correct from my point of view that all of it is about avoiding what is essentially a moral evaluation, taking seriously our capacity to evaluate human practice morally and recognize that those practices, when they're inconsistent with what we claim to be our moral principles, have to be discarded. Yet when we're talking about these systems, we're not just talking about, you know, changing the way markets work or eliminating pornography. We're really talking about a fundamental shift in how we understand ourselves, how we understand our relationship to each other, and then, of course, as you've written about so often, how we need to change our understanding of our place in that larger living world.
Well, thank you for that answer, and that seems like a really good place for us to break for the station. So we will break now for a moment. Okay, so we were supposed to break, and then they're going to insert something there, and now we can now we can start up again. You ready?
Yep.
You know, I've been reading. I just finished writing a book on some of the problems in anarchism. One of them is that's very very masculinist. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that was just cracking me up in not in a particularly good way is that I was seeing a lot of defenses of pornography written by men.
Yes.
And then I was thinking about this again when you said that Thomas Jefferson was writing in defense of slavery. Mm-hmm. And it just strikes me as extraordinary that any members, and it doesn't matter what we're talking about, whether it's human supremacism, white supremacism, male supremacism, it doesn't matter. It always strikes me as I don't understand why they don't feel like just ridiculous and feel like complete, I don't know, wankers because they are members of an oppressor class arguing for the use of something that is at the very least potentially harmful to members of an oppressed class. And it seems to me that as members of an oppressor class, you don't get to do that.
Well,
it just seems. I mean, I would feel really ridiculous as a human being arguing for human supremacism over non-humans because it's obviously self-serving. That's my point. And I would feel the same. I would feel very ridiculous as a white person arguing in favor of things that promote white supremacy.
Yeah. I think you're right, of course, in some sort of principled way, but, you know, we don't always reflect and reason from a position of principle. Human beings are messy creatures. And so I was immediately taking your comment and thinking about my own development as a human being. So in, you know, my younger years, really up until my late 20s, I had no feminist analysis. I hadn't been, you know, taught to think that way. I hadn't interacted with people who thought that way. I grew up in a pretty traditional mainstream America world. My predominantly male friends certainly weren't thinking about feminism, and the women who were in my circles, if they had feminist leanings, weren't articulating them clearly and asking men to be accountable. This was, you know, the late 70s, early 80s is the era I'm talking about, when already the incredible energy and passion of the second wave of feminism was starting to dissipate in the United States. So I grew up surrounded by people who told me that everything that looked normal was in fact normal, that guys using pornography was normal, that guys talking about how to make sure they could have sex with as many women as possible with as little commitment as possible was normal. And so, you know, when I would have made defenses of pornography or defenses of male sexual behavior in my, let's say, my 20s, I wouldn't even have been aware of the point you're making, because I wasn't aware of the deep patriarchal nature of the culture. I wasn't aware about just the facts of sexual violence. I wasn't aware of any of that. So I couldn't really see the contradiction in my own arguments because I simply didn't know anything. Now, I was extremely fortunate. I went back to graduate school, which is not always a way that one comes alive politically. Often graduate school, you know, snubs out the political passion of people. But in my case, I got lucky and was confronted with feminist work, was confronted by feminist women and a few feminist men, and was forced to answer the question you just posed. And I think in a kind of curious way, the fact that I was such an unsophisticated person, I came from a very kind of plain background without a lot of intellectual pretension, the power of the feminist argument seemed so obvious to me once I was exposed to it that I didn't spend a lot of time fighting it. It just seemed kind of obvious to me in the way that you're saying. And I'm very serious when I say part of the reason I think that worked that way for me is because I wasn't intellectually sophisticated enough to put up a lot of complex defenses. So in the best case scenario, I think, when men in this case, or white people in that case, can engage honestly and openly with people with a critical point of view, it's possible to transcend that. Now, I'm not saying it was simple or easy or that it's a finished project, but that's why, even though the way you're talking, for instance, and the way you often write is called radical. Well, what's the point of bringing up these big systems? They haven't changed in hundreds of years, and they're not going to change. Well, that may be true. I mean, I'm sure that patriarchy will be going strong on the day of my funeral. I'm sure that white supremacy will not have been transcended in my lifetime. But the possibility to create conditions to challenge those systems more effectively depends on people. And you cannot help people see the inherent immoral nature. And I use that term even though people often like to talk about political issues in moral terms, but I think we mean here moral in that it's inconsistent with our own moral principles that have to deal with equality and the dignity of all people, that these systems are immoral. And the only way you can help people come to understand that is by naming it honestly. So again, what many people reject as a unrealistic strategy, I think, is in fact the only hope we have. Because precisely as you say, the the skills of denial are very well developed in this culture and in human beings in general, I think.
I guess I want to tell a quick story and then I guess ask a couple more questions. And the quick story has to do with this. When I was a teenager, I grew up Christian fundamentalist, Seventh-day Adventist, actually. And so, you know, I had a lot of the stuff from this culture that way. And
right.
In school, the use of the derogatory fag was really common among everybody at the public school where I went. And I used the term all the time. And I didn't specifically mean anything by it because it was just an insult you said to somebody.
Sure.
And one of the things that really helped me pass that was I had a bisexual friend who one day I was teaching him how to drive, and he ran my car into a pole. And I said, "Oh, you fag." And he responded by saying, "Yeah, I am, but what does that have to do with me running your car into a pole?" And a couple points here. One of them is I suddenly realized that this wasn't some abstract insult that I could sling around to somebody who missed a basketball shot. Instead, it actually was a harmful, derogatory term toward a class of people. Up until then, it had never, I'd used the term, you know, hundreds or thousands of times. It had never occurred to me that it was an actual, tangible offense against a class.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess that's the reason I bring up that story is because it had, is because my homophobia was so completely invisible to me that it never occurred to me until he said that. And then so the good news is that as soon as he said it, I got the picture. The bad news is, and this I think is how people change a lot of times, that doesn't mean I stopped using the word. It took me about another year to metabolize that change and to, even for something so simple as not using that overt hate speech, it took me about a year to excise it from my vocabulary.
Yeah.
And I guess I just bring that up in terms of, I think, for me at least, that's one of the ways that change happens is that it's not because, yeah, somebody makes a really great argument to you when you're in grad school, and then, but that doesn't mean that everything about you has changed. You know, it takes time to incorporate those changes.
Absolutely. And if I can connect that story, which certainly resonates with me, although my own experience is somewhat different, that's why the severe reaction that the dominant culture, especially conservative elements of it, had to what was always derisively called the PC, the politically correct instinct, was so important. Because as you're pointing out, one doesn't become aware of an injustice, whether it's in language or in material conditions or in politics or whatever, and then just automatically fix it. You know, and this is sort of Aristotle's point about habit. Virtue is not simply achieved by knowing the right thing to do. It's a habit that has to be inculcated. Now, Aristotle's notion of what was virtuous might have been a little off in cases, but I think that's very true. And that's why the attending to language is so important, and why the right wing especially, but the dominant culture more generally, loved to laugh at people who tried to take language seriously. I right now go to a Christian church. I always have to explain it's a Christian church where nobody believes in God and nobody believes in the resurrection. So it's a somewhat unorthodox Christian church. But it's a church where people are trying to use that tradition for progressive, even radical ends, both theologically and politically. And it's a church where not only do we not use gendered language for the concept of God. So there's never a hymn sung or a sermon preached where we talk about praising him. But beyond that, our minister, who I think is quite innovative, has even banished the word Lord. He said, you know, the idea of a Lord comes out of hierarchy. It comes out of, you know, the Lord of the manor over the serfs. And he said, why do you want a God who is your Lord? And so this attending to language is very, very powerful, and it helps us shift the way we think about concepts of the divine and community and spirituality. And people love to make fun of churches like this, saying, oh, it's just PC, you know. But what we're trying to do is, through daily practice, including language, change the way we think. And that's crucial, and it's hard. And anyone listening, especially, I think, men who were taught to talk about women in certain ways, or straight people taught to talk about gays in certain ways, we all know that it's a real struggle. And it takes a community. It takes people committed to it, because it's very hard to do on your own. I still remember that when I left graduate school, where I had been part of a very vibrant feminist student community, and came to teach, and I lost that sense of a feminist community, I realized my language changed. I was sort of falling back into old habits, not using words like fag, but just being less aware of certain things. And, you know, that was just, to me, a reminder that it's always hard to go it alone. And when people get together to try and challenge these kinds of injustices, that's why the dominant culture comes down so hard on them, whether it's through violence, through, you know, the kind of very overt reaction you see to certain kinds of movements, or whether it tries to undermine those movements just by ridiculing them. It's all part of the same fear the dominant culture has that, in fact, these movements are correct. They're pointing out the gap between the stated moral principles of the culture and the actual experience of living in the culture.
So I guess the last two questions, and we're running out of time. One question would be, we all know that as ways of life collapse, as economic systems collapse, that men's violence against women increases. Mm-hmm. And we also know that that racism becomes more overt as economic systems collapse. And so I'm wondering what people of good heart can do as the current economic collapse continues, whether through peak oil, ecological collapse, further economic collapse, you know, just what capitalism does. What can we do in tangible sense as men, women, whites, people of color, any other category? What can we do to soften that violence that comes during that collapse?
Well, that's a really difficult question, because the underlying reality you're describing, I think, is accurate. And it's hard to be glib, because the collapse, the sort of decay of systems that you're talking about, is not some sort of science fiction future. That's the reality we're watching unfold today. All I can say, maybe, is by way of example, a project here in Austin, where I live, where we've tried to deal with that in our day-to-day lives. Some groups, one predominantly white, one predominantly Latino, came together and bought a community center, which serves as office space and event space for a number of groups. And it's put in one place people who normally, in a highly segregated community like Austin, wouldn't mix, a predominantly immigrant and Latino group and a predominantly white and middle-class group. And creating, you know, that kind of place where people can come together and get to know each other, and I don't want to be naive, you know, if we all just got along, everything would be perfect. I don't mean that. But where we have to practice at being our best selves is very important. The immigrant worker group, which is housed in that building, is importantly led by women, mostly younger women and very progressive women. And they have made a kind of underlying feminist politics the norm of that building, to the point where when the immigrant worker group, which received some of its grant funding from a Catholic group, was asked to sign a statement, as many groups were in that period, denouncing gay-lesbian relationships and making sure that they would toe the line on Catholic theology on that, this immigrant worker group refused to accept a grant if the condition of the grant was signing heterosexist, homophobic promise like that. And I took that to be a great indication of what is possible when people come together and really listen to each other. So immigrant workers who came from predominantly Catholic backgrounds, who might not have come into the organization with pro-gay lesbian feelings through this process had come to the point where they were happy to reject funding to make a principled stand. And I thought, wow, you know, the world is maybe heading off the cliff, but at least in the time we're here, we can try to cultivate these kinds of relationships, create spaces for them, and make that part of our political practice. Again, I don't want to be naive. I don't suggest that that kind of communal spirit can, you know, overcome capitalism tomorrow. But it's a start. It's a place where we can kind of hold on. And I think, you know, in that sense, some of the most important political action these days is local. It's where people are coming together on the ground to deal with specific problems, not just to, you know, pass a new ordinance or get a new policy enacted, but to change the way we live with each other. That's the, in some ways, you know, the best I can do, but it's also the most heartening part of my own political activity these days.
I guess the last question, and thank you for all that, I guess the last question is, as you've been talking about the denial, I've been thinking about this great quote by the American Indian writer Jack Forbes, and I'm just wondering if you can respond to that. He wrote, "What I came to realize is this. If a creature learns to completely accept captivity or slavery, if they erase all thoughts of freedom, they can suppress the pain. But if one wants to be free, one has to face the pain. One has to agonize, to suffer through all the terror. One has to face up to what has happened, to face up to one's complete degradation." And I'm wondering if that difficult process provides one of our ways through or out of or past patriarchy, capitalism, supremacism.
Yeah, I think that's right on target, that we have to have faith in freedom. And by freedom, I don't mean, you know, some superficial political manipulation of that term, you know, in contemporary American politics. I mean a deep sense that we are, in fact, free, free to love, and in a sense, free from the need to condition our own sense of safety on the exploitation of anyone else. That's what true freedom means. And how we achieve that, how we overcome the incredible impediments that this culture puts in the way of us really feeling free, really being free and being able to act on it, even in the face of fear and terror, that might be the most succinct summary of the political challenge we face. And the impediments are not just, you know, state violence or the concentration of wealth. The impediments are the cheap and easy pleasures of the contemporary world, you know, cheap food, cheap drugs, cheap entertainment, mass spectacle entertainment. There's a lot of things to dull the pain, and in that sense it may sound kind of paradoxical and maybe counterintuitive, but political organizing to some degree might be about helping people feel that pain rather than dull it.
Well, and that's why community, I think, is so important. It's because it's very hard to go through that process alone.
No, I would say it's impossible to go through it alone. You will go mad if you try to work this out. You know, just as a way to make this tangible again, when I give talks on the feminist critique of pornography, I often get young men who come up and say, "I agree with that analysis. I've had trouble with my own use of pornography. It's constrained my imagination. I feel addicted to it. I can't stop. It's ruining my relationship with my girlfriend." I hear all of these kinds of things. And they'll say, "What can I do?" And I'm smart enough not to pretend to have an easy answer, but I always say the same thing. I say, whatever you do, you're going to have to do with others. If you try and go it alone, if you try and, you know, end your addictive pattern of use of pornography by yourself, you'll never succeed, because you'll always be lured back into it. It takes a community to keep us individually strong enough, and that's part of the, you know, the perverse genius of capitalism is its destruction of community, because the reward for destroying community is wealth and power. And therefore, in capitalism, community will be and has been destroyed. And it's our task to rebuild it, and not some superficial notion of community that, you know, involves, I don't know, a a recreation center where we all get together and, you know, play checkers, but real community where people are responsible for each other. And that's not easy to create in this culture, but it is, I think you're right, the core of any kind of progressive or radical politics.
Well, thank you so much, Bob. I would love to do this again sometime.
So would I. It's very stimulating thoughts, and I'm really grateful for it. It got me thinking a lot, so thanks.
Thank you very much for listening. My guest today has been Robert Jensen. This is Derek Jensen for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.